Is that working? Hello all. Thanks very much, Eric, for the introduction. I am a New Zealander. I don't know how strong my accent still is. I've been living away from New Zealand for some time now. And it's great to have such a full room of you all, so thanks very much for coming. It's wonderful to speak on this theme today, I think, because as many of you... Is that better? Who've been following the news, it's a very topical time to be talking about displacement, development and climate change. This morning, many of you may have read the news that we saw in Calais, the jungle, the refugee and asylum migrant camp being broken up. And at the global level, we've had major developments in this area in the last year. In December, in Paris, of course, the climate change agreement, which was recently ratified. We've had also in the migration sphere some real breakthroughs. We had in September the highest level summit on migration and refugees, which was held at the UN General Assembly. And then in October, just a couple of weeks ago, we had the announcement of the new UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. He won over a number of very, very also qualified women. One of them was from my own country, from New Zealand, Helen Clark, who's head of the UN Development Programme. And Guterres was elected partly for his great experience at leading the High Commission as the High Commissioner for Refugees, and one of the organisations I'll be speaking about today. So this issue is one that is very alive, thinking about the interconnections between displacement, development and climate change at the global level. And the question that my book really addresses is how have our international development and humanitarian organisations responded to climate change? Are they moving beyond their mandates? Because these are organisations, these are international institutions that were all set up in a very different era. How many of you here, just out of interest, are students of international relations, international politics? Just get a raise. How many of you are students of development studies? Got a few. Migration or refugee focus? Climate change? Okay, now that's useful to know. So we've got a real intersection in the room. That's great. So many of the international institutions that maybe you've studied in your classes, if it be on international relations, were set up in the post-World War II era. And in fact, they were set up to deal with a very specific set of problems, which really came as the fallout of war in Europe. And the questions that I'm asking is, well, how have these institutions, including the High Commission for Refugees, the United Nations Development Programme, and the International Organization for Migration, how are they adapting to new challenges? And climate change is the one that I focus on. So why focus on climate change? As many of you in the room who are studying it, and probably most of you in the room regardless, are very aware, climate change is leading to an increase in the severity and the frequency of natural disasters. We're also seeing sea level rise in many parts of the world, where the Pacific, where I'm from, there's a great concern that low-lying atoll states like this one, Kiribati, may eventually not be inhabitable, less because they're sinking. Actually, more at the moment, one of the big problems is the inundation of salt water in groundwater, which makes the water obviously undrinkable and unusable. You've also got in the Horn of Africa increasing frequency of droughts, which can lead to famine. This photo I took outside of the Kakuma refugee camp where I did some research. Kakuma is right on the border between what is now South Sudan and Kenya, and near Uganda. I was there conducting research for this work. There's also, of course, an increasing likelihood there'll be flooding in many countries from Bangladesh to the Philippines. And in 2015, natural disasters left over 22,000 people dead. It affected 98.6 million others and caused over $66 billion of economic damage. So these are major, major problems for the international community to respond to, particularly as many of them are happening in developing countries. Yet the international community spends less than half of 1% of the global aid budget on mitigating the risk posed by such hazards. And climate change is, as I was saying, affecting all of us, but developing countries are bearing the brunt of it. So my research starts from the starting point that we need to understand how our global institutions, who are responsible for development and for humanitarian assistance, are responding. So as I mentioned already, these are the three organisations that I focus in on. Now, I could have looked at many others. Obviously, the World Bank, the World Food Programme, OCHA. There are a number of organisations involved in humanitarian development assistance. Now, I focus on these three for several reasons. Firstly, they're very understudied, particularly around climate change. There's no other research that I've come across that looks at these three institutions and asks, how are they responding to climate change? They're also leading institutions in terms of UNDP, leads the UN's development work. They coordinate across different UN agencies, but they also do a lot of development assistance themselves and have projects in over 100 countries. UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, as many of you will be familiar with, does assist refugees, offers legal protection, but has also expanded into a lot of humanitarian assistance in situations of internally displaced peoples and statelessness. And the last one, perhaps the most interesting in terms of topical news, is actually the least known. It's the International Organization for Migration, a little known organization set up by the Americans after World War II, and just in the last month has been integrated into the UN system. It's one of the few organizations of its kind that had remained outside of the UN system. And we can talk a bit more about that in Q&A. These organizations also were all established around the same time period, that post-war time period, which makes them useful to compare. And they're all organizations with sizable bureaucracies. They have between 6,500 and 9,000 staff. These staff are international civil servants who work and aligned with their mandate of the organization, not with member states. So they're not a Japanese person who is there on behalf of the Japanese government. They are there as UNHCR or UNDP or IOM. And that is important because they differ as well from other international organizations. Sometimes you think about like the UNFCCC, which have small secretariats, and then the bulk of the people who come and meet at Paris are governments, are member states. So the essential argument that I make in this book is that all three of these organizations have moved beyond their original mandates. None of them were set up with a mandate for environment or climate change, which of course probably comes as no surprise. In the 1950s and the 60s, this wasn't an issue. But neither did states delegate them to work on climate change. So they all have, in the last 15 years, started to work to assist people who are affected by climate change, but they weren't instructed to do so by states. Now, this is interesting for us from an international relations perspective because member states set up these organizations. They create them. They're the ones who fund them. They're the ones who sit on the boards and decide the strategy. They're the ones who monitor what they do. So we would expect, in many international relations theories, that they would be the ones who tell them when to expand their mandates. So the puzzle, if you like, is then why are they expanding? What explains it? And the essential argument that runs through the book is that expansion in these organizations wasn't due to the states, but actually due to the staff. These international civil servants who work in these organizations based around the world and headquarters in New York and Geneva. And they don't just expand because they always want to expand. The argument's a little bit nuanced. They do so when they perceive that a new issue like climate change links to their core mandate. Well, that may seem obvious, but I'll walk through why this is actually important. So first of all, I'm arguing that the staff are the drivers of mandate expansion, not states, and I'm arguing that it's based on their perception of how issues link together. Now, this contrasts from existing explanations. I've already talked about some of the what I'd call state-driven explanations, but also other explanations exist for expansion of these intergovernmental organizations. One of them is that international civil servants will always seek to expand, what Eric was referring to, this generic tendency that we often see in bureaucracies to just expand and increase their scope, the number of tasks that they do. Others argue that in intergovernmental organizations, actually, we might see the opposite. We might expect, this is the second idea, that staff internalize their state preferences, that preferences are that states don't want these bureaucracies to expand. They're already concerned at how many things they're doing. And so the staff almost censor themselves and restrain themselves to keep their organization alive. Now, I'm arguing something else. I'm arguing that they will actually expand when and if they see a good reason for it. And we'll unpack that. So the contributions I'm making with this book are to our theories of international institution, what drives them to expand, what explains the staff, the civil servants in these organizations' desire to take on new issue areas. Why would they want to take on climate change or another new issue area, gay rights? What would motivate them to do so, given they're already very busy? And more broadly, this book also contributes to our understanding of global governance, of climate change, of adaptation. How are these institutions helping developing countries and vulnerable people around the world to deal with the impacts of climate change? So the structure of the book is the introduction, then I look at issue linkages, how issues get connected. And I'm going to talk through that next. And then I'll look in particular at the UNHCR and IOM case studies to draw out the contrast of what this actually looks like in practice. To give you a sense of how I went about doing this research, so I spent several years doing extensive interviews with international organizations, NGOs, also with states. I interviewed over 140 people from here, New York, we have on the left, and right through to, this is in Somalia, on the border of Somalia in Dadaab refugee camp, which at the time and still is the largest refugee camp in the world, with about 1 million people, mostly from Somalia, who fled across the border into Kenya. The Kenyan government's recently announced that they're closing it down, but it's still unclear exactly if and how that will happen. So I conducted interviews. I also did a lot of primary document analysis, looking at all of these organizations' policies, their speeches on climate change, and attended some of the negotiations in Paris. There were also some important discussions in Oslo over what's called the Nansen Initiative. And I focused on a 15-year time frame from 2000 to 2015. So I looked at how UNHCR, UNDP, and IOM worked on climate change in that period. And obviously organizational change or manner is a big, broad thing. How do I operationalize that? How do I actually examine it? So I looked at five dimensions. I looked at rhetoric. What was coming out of these organizations, in particular from the top? What were the heads of these organizations, the administrators, the executive directors, saying about climate change? What policy was coming out? What policy papers and substantive thinking? How were the organizations changing internally? Were they creating new divisions, new departments? Because that symbolizes that they're creating, they're making it a priority area if you're investing in new staff and recruiting new expertise. Fourthly, I looked at operations, what was happening on the ground. That's what took me to Kenya. And then overall mandate, what was changing within the discussions at the member state level. Now, here, many of us now take it for granted that climate change has an impact on health, on migration, on development. It may have come as no surprise, the title Climate Change, Displacement, Development, the link of those things. But this was not always the case. If you rewound back to the early 90s, which I do in the book, climate change was conceived much narrower as an environmental problem. It was one of five big environmental problems coming out of the Rio conference. It was not seen as a humanitarian issue or as a development issue. And the sorts of people that would go to the negotiations, the people that followed it, was much narrower. And what I do, and what's important for us to understand, is that in the 2000s, how we conceived of climate change has broadened. So we've become much more aware of the impacts of climate change on humans, not just on polar bears. And we saw this as well at the UNFCCC negotiations, where this is a photo taken from the Copenhagen negotiations, where we have a side panel event. So there's obviously the main negotiations that are happening with member states, but alongside it, there are a number of side events where interest groups, lobby groups, civil society actors will hold thematic discussions on things that they think negotiators should be taking into account. And this one was on climate change and displacement. This was a panel with Antonio Guterres, on second from the end on the left, the head of UNHCR at the time, William Lacy Swing, who is the head of the International Organization for Migration, and as well as Walter Carlin, who was head at that point, he was the UN Special Rapporteur for the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Peoples. Now, at the start of the climate change negotiations in the 90s, you would not have expected people, the heads of these organisations, to be attending. You would not have even expected these organisations at all to have an interest. Why would they go to a discussion about how to reduce greenhouse gases? The link between climate change and displacement was not a strong, clear link in the early 90s. It became much stronger a link. And so what I look at is how these linkages between areas that seem quite discrete, climate change, displacement, came to be seen as connected. And that's a substantive issue linkage, when two areas are causally linked to each other. And this happened, and I trace this emergence of this linkage in the mid-90s and 2000s. So one IPCC report predicted that the greatest single consequence of climate change could be millions of people displaced by shoreline erosion, coastal flooding, and severe drought. It argued that even a modest rise in global sea levels could produce tens of millions of environmental refugees. That was an important term, environmental or climate refugees. And this message was echoed by many academics, like Norman Myers. He published in academic journals arguing we might see over 250 million climate refugees. We saw NGOs like Greenpeace, Oxfam also making this call that climate change was going to have disastrous humanitarian impacts, including refugees and displacement. However, there was a pushback. Academics like Richard Black, who's actually based in London, challenged these claims because they argued the link between climate change and displacement or migration is not so clear-cut. It's much more complex. It's not directly causal. You can't just say that climate change will always cause people to move. Not everyone is forced to leave when there's a natural disaster. In fact, sometimes the people that stay are the worst off, if you think about Hurricane Katrina. So if we start creating categories of people based on the idea that climate change causes everyone to move and that they are the most vulnerable, it's very problematic. And I'm happy to talk more about this link because it's very important for us to understand the complexity behind the link between climate change and displacement. For the purposes of the talk, though, I think what's important to realise is that there was a link that was made, but it was accepted that it was very complex. So climate change is a threat multiplier. It will have an impact on people's lives. It will lead some to move, but that also political, socioeconomic contexts are also very important. Now, this issue linkage, though, formed the basis. The fact that academics and NGOs started to talk about the link between climate change and displacement is important for understanding why, then, we would expect UNHCR to be involved. Because UNHCR, we wouldn't expect to be involved in a conversation about reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. This doesn't make much sense. So what do we know about UNHCR? Well, it was established in 1950 as a small office of lawyers in Geneva. There was about 34 of them. They could all fit around a piano. Now there's over 9,000. They certainly can't fit around a piano. And it was tasked with overseeing the convention relating to the status of the refugees, which is what they're signing here. Now, importantly, as many of you who focus on this area will be aware, refugees were defined very narrowly in this convention. They're only people with a well-founded fear of persecution based for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, and that they also are outside their country and unwilling to return because of that fear of persecution. That does not include somebody who's left their country because of sea level rise, natural disasters, or any other slow onset climate change events. You are not a refugee under the Refugee Convention if you are affected by climate change. Now, of course, the office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has expanded in terms of the people it looks after. It now does cover and work with internally displaced peoples. It also works with stateless people, and it's developed a large humanitarian operation division. However, that core definition remains. That's a very important part of UNHCR's mandate. And that's interesting and relevant for us because staff guard that convention and they are very loyal to the convention and protecting refugees' unique rights. Why? Because if you fit in that category, we know it's such a loaded term, because then you get particular legal rights for protection. You cannot be returned to a land to where you may be persecuted, tortured, killed. Now, that's only that high level of what's called non-refoulement only offered to refugees. So that's why it's so important as a political category. And what's interesting is that UNHCR staff were actually very reluctant to engage with debates that were put forward by groups like Greenpeace or academics over climate refugees. They refuted the term. They refused to embrace the new terminology of environmental or climate refugees. And they feared that it would complicate and confuse the organization's efforts to protect the victims of persecution and armed conflict. So the very first policy paper that they produced in 2008 on the issue, they argued strongly against the term climate change refugee, and they stated it was misleading, and I quote them, potentially dangerous term. UNHCR was very, very concerned about the terminology that was used. However, the High Commissioner, who's now the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, had a broader view of UNHCR's mandate. He saw it as an agency for displaced peoples. And he emphasized some of the new mega, what he called mega trends that were driving displacement, which he included climate change as one of them. And he took a role, he took a leading role in trying to lobby states from 2000 onwards to expand the mandate of UNHCR. And there were two dimensions to that expansion that he wanted. One, to include protection for those displaced internationally across borders by climate change. Two, to assist internally displaced peoples who are affected by natural disasters. So they're two separate groups. At Copenhagen in 2009, for instance, he stated that the international community must develop new mechanisms for the protection of climate refugees. So here he's making a very ambitious call. We need protection. We need something on the same level as the Refugee Convention. And other policy papers sort of echoed this view, and it really, he got the bureaucracy on side. So what happened? There were two shifts in UNHCR's work. One was ended up successful, the other to a lesser extent. One was normative. The High Commissioner trying to push ambitiously for this new protection mandate for people who were displaced internationally. And he asked, actually, in 2011, at a ministerial meeting, a number of states, he asked all the member states, to offer UNHCR an additional protection role. He said, we've got the Refugee Convention, will you sign up to develop something additional that will protect those people who don't fall under the Refugee Convention but are being displaced by climate change? And member states, almost all of them, apart from four or five, rejected this attempt. They said, we will not expand or agree to develop any new protection frameworks. Interestingly, the few states, including Norway, Germany, Switzerland, that did, were sympathetic to this call, set up what's called the Nansen Initiative. Some of you may have followed this, and they then came up with more bottom-up proposals for how they can think about protection for people who are displaced across borders, but doing so much more at a regional level. And the Nansen Initiative had a sort of culmination in October last year where they discussed their protection agenda. But overall, the High Commissioner didn't succeed to get any new framework or a new convention that would work with people displaced across borders by natural disasters. Operationally, though, he had a little more success. And I think this is partly because he just worked de facto, in a way, just started to expand and didn't actually seek in the same way that he had, for the former example, a mandate. And what UNHCR did here is that they expanded to offer assistance to many internally displaced peoples. So they did so in Cyclone Nargis in Myanmar in 2008, in Pakistan earthquake, Philippines floods, later Pakistan floods, Haitian earthquake. They were in Ecuador this year. They're in Haiti now. And here they're offering humanitarian assistance, blankets, food, beds, working with other humanitarian actors to people who are still within their country but have been displaced by a natural disaster. So they're not offering the same level of legal protection that they would offer refugees because obviously the people are still within their country. So in summary, for the UNHCR case, what we saw is UNHCR did move beyond their mandate. And they did so, I would argue, because they had a proactive High Commissioner who was really pushing the organisation to expand. And he was able to lobby states to get some degree of expansion. Now, in contrast, This is William Lacey Swing. He's he was a former ambassador for America in the Congo. IOM, interestingly, has almost always had American heads because it has a long-standing relationship. The American government set up the organization, and it was originally a provisional committee for the movement of migrants from Europe. And it had a fleet of boats, and it took boats in the post-war era from Europe to Australia, to the Americas, full of labour migrants. So this was an organisation that was trying to help people move out of Europe for labour purposes. And its mandate continues to be promoting orderly and humane migration that benefits society and migrants. So like UNHCR, of course, it didn't have any mandate for natural disaster displacement. This isn't what was happening in post-war Europe. And it was also, as we've noted, established outside the UN system. In the intervening years between its establishment in 1951 and today, it also expanded its mandate into humanitarian assistance and also thinking about the relationship between environment and migration. From 2008 onwards, it really started to take a role on climate change and tried to make itself known as the expert on climate change and migration. They published a number of research reports, held seminars, workshops, but states pushed back. States were initially reluctant to finance and discuss climate change and migration at IOM. They did not want to make it the focus of the agency's work. The organization continued to lobby. This was mostly led by the bureaucracy rather than by the director, William Lacey Swing. And one of the things that I think it's important to notice is they were aware that there was a complex relationship between climate change and migration. And they also were lobbying to see migration as something positive, as an adaptation strategy. They wanted states in the climate change negotiations to actually include migration as an adaptation strategy to deal with the impacts of climate change. And they had great success alongside other actors in gaining this achievement with paragraph 14F in the Cancun Agreement in 2010, which did acknowledge migration as an adaptation strategy. The key difference, as I've mentioned, though, with UNHCR is that a lot of these changes were being pushed by some of the civil servants. However, the Director General, William Lacey Swing, and his predecessor, Brunson McKinley, were also on board with some of these changes, and they talked about the fact that in today's reality, climate change and environmental degradation are triggering migration and displacement. And Swing also said that migration was not a worst-case scenario, but that should be part of our response to climate change. So did they expand their mandate? I would argue yes, they also expanded their mandate, and they got member states to agree in 2009 and 2010 to endorse their work on climate change and migration. And interestingly, they, like UNHCR, expanded their humanitarian operations to assist people affected by natural disasters, so working in a number of the same situations I mentioned for UNHCR. They were also doing a range of other activities, which were sometimes, I would argue, slightly tangentially related to climate change, environment, and migration. In Kenya, I visited some of their work where they were trying to assist nomadic pastoralists to take on more agriculture and to grow crops, which is a very highly politicized area, and they were facing a lot of criticism from local politicians. But for a theoretical understanding, what we can see again is that the expansion was driven by the civil servants or the international bureaucrats who saw it as an important area for them to be working on. So, conclusion. What we can take away from the book in terms of the theoretical key arguments is that the staff rather than states were pushing and lobbying for mandate expansion over time, and they were doing so based on what they argued were issue linkages between, in this case, climate change and migration, climate change and displacement. And these explanation holds over the alternative explanations because we didn't see staff always try to expand. UNHCR staff were actually reluctant. They didn't always want to expand to new issue areas. And the second explanation that I put up at the beginning, that staff internalized state preferences and would restrain themselves from expansion, also doesn't hold because we saw people like Guterres trying to expand. So what are some of the broad implications? Obviously, there's many more, and I'm looking forward to the Q&A and to the discussion. I think just three that I would highlight is, one, the influence of leaders. how much do they lead and drive expansion? We saw Guterres being particularly strong expansionist leader. Is he going to do a similar thing as UN Secretary General? Secondly, it's unlikely that we're going to have new international conventions or protection for people specifically displaced by climate change, I would argue, although there's some progress. We can talk about that more in question and answer. And I would also just like to throw open this question. Is mandate expansion good? Is it good that our international institutions always evolve and adapt? Should they be expanding into all issues? Because sometimes it seemed to me in the research that I did, they were expanding into new areas where they didn't have expertise, and actually the work that they were doing was not very effective and it possibly even more harmful. So I'll leave it at that and look forward to the question and answer. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I think we definitely have a lot of interesting questions and answers later on. But I first want to give the floor to Robert Faulkner. Robert is an associate professor in the International Relations Department and an internationally recognized authority on governance of climate issues and climate negotiations and so on. So, Robert, what is your reaction to this book?
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you, Eric, for organizing this, and thank you to Nina for having me as your discussant here. I should start by saying that PhD theses normally don't make good books. And I'll explain that. And my own PhD thesis never made it into pure book form. I reworked it and added two more cases, and then it came out much, much later as a book. So the first thing to say is this is a beautifully written, very accessible, and just a pleasurable read. And so congratulations for having worked against the grain of what most publishers say about PhD thesis. You've done a terrific job translating the thesis into the book, or the thesis was publishable from the beginning. Whichever one it is, it's just a pure pleasure to read. It's clearly structured. It has a beautiful flow to it. And the work that you've put into it, you mention on one page that you've done 150 interviews. Now, I don't know whether any of you have done interview-based research. 150, does it sound like a lot? It sounds like a hell of a lot. My last project involved 65 interviews, and we were three people doing those interviews. So I think you have to read the whole book to just appreciate how much work has gone into this. And this is indeed novel empirical work. I don't know of any comparable study in this field that has achieved that. So I think that is fantastic. The second point I want to make is that how refreshing it is to have a book on international organizations that takes them very seriously. Now, I say this as an international relations scholar, and you may find that surprising. Actually, most of our students in IR find that surprising. They come to the OSCE, I'm talking about undergraduates, and you meet them in the first week and you ask them, what do you want to do later on? And they'll say, I want to join an international organization and change the world. And then we take 3 years to talk them out of that because in international relations, unfortunately, I'm talking about IR, not about all the other wonderful disciplines at the LSE, we believe, of course, that real power agency lies somewhere else, not in international organizations. Now, I don't happen to believe in that, and I do take international organizations seriously, and every now and then a good book comes along that proves my colleagues wrong, and right what I do. So in this case, I now know which book to recommend to some of my skeptics in the department, and they will have to read that. I also found it very instructive to see how you've retold the story of how migration emerged in the climate change scene. Because as you say, it emerged from within the debate on adaptation. And I must confess, I don't work on adaptation. I follow very much in the trap of very old-style climate policy scholars who focus on mitigation straight away. And my last paper that came out on the Paris Agreement has a little footnote saying, and in this paper I focus entirely on mitigation, not adaptation. So I read that section with great interest and very carefully. And what you bring out very beautifully is just how much the international agenda has changed. back in the early 2000s, in the sort of the period when we were debating about how to implement the Kyoto Protocol, adaptation was still seen, as you note in the book, as a threat to the global climate agenda, to any serious effort to make climate policy work, because it would distract from the mitigation effort. If we didn't cut down on emissions, then everything else was lost. And you very nicely show how that was both an unsustainable discourse and framing of the debate, but also how we've long moved on to that. What's more, you show that the original framing of migration also changed dramatically from a kind of a threat scenario, the alarmist scenario, which of course was part of the effort to securitize climate change in the 2000s, in the run-up to the Copenhagen conference. Big efforts were made by a lot of analysts and policymakers to demonstrate that climate migrants would be, well, the hordes that we needed to stop through mitigation. What a fallacious framing that was. I remember spending a sabbatical in America in 2006-07, and as it happened, I had lunch with a colleague from the UK. He was from the Ministry of Defence, and he said to me, doesn't happen very often, he said to me, we must have lunch. I said, why? I work on climate change. And this defence expert said, so do I. I said, that's a bit strange. Were you in a different sort of business? And he said, no, I was given a sabbatical to work exactly on the security risks arising from climate change, and he wanted me to predict migration flows over the coming decades. I said, I work on mitigation, not adaptation, so I wouldn't know. And it's interesting how that debate has really had to be rethought, and you do a really good job tracing that evolution, which is just wonderful. Now, what about international organizations? Coming back to that IR skepticism. And let me just see how far you've pushed the discipline in dropping that old line of IO skepticism. I still think IOs play a bit of a marginal role in international relations, and I think your book clearly pushes us in the right direction. It's an emerging field, and it's one that needs careful analysis. I think the problem was in the past, international organizations were taken at surface value. They were treated as if they were indeed international authorities by definition of being created through international cooperation, through legal texts that gave them some form of legal mandate. But the problem in the literature used to be we translated mandate into authority, into power. And that very quickly ended up, from a research perspective, but also from a political agency perspective, into a cul-de-sac. A mandate doesn't give you very much leverage in international organization, in international politics. The mandate itself could be irrelevant if it wasn't backed up by serious power, by financial authority, by organizational capability, by networking capability, and so on. So the mandate itself was never a good predictor of power. But that's not where you go, and I think that's why it's important to engage in this agenda. There are two other literatures that have emerged. I just want to mention them here, that also show how agencies, international organizations have gone beyond their mandates, but in ways that you don't capture. So in a way, your work sits nicely along other emerging work, which is doing really good work here. The first literature, which I'm sure you're familiar because you work with Duncan Snidel at Oxford, is the whole literature on orchestration. International organizations now very much try and boost their influence in international relations by engaging with other actors, particularly non-state actors, circumventing states, reaching out into the sort of what we call the transnational governance realms, and in getting other actors to do the governance work for them, often in support of international organization mandates. There's a terrific amount of conceptual and empirical work that's come out now, also on climate change. Tom Hale, you know him from Oxford days and so on, people who've worked on the role that IOs play as orchestrators. In other words, going beyond their mandates by getting other actors to do their work, a sort of a governance extension work. And that's a different line of argument, but I think it would be interesting to see much more cross-fertilization between your work and their work. And the other line of research is about what organizations like the UN do and the Secretariat do, and indeed the Secretary General, we'll see what Guterres can do there, which is to manage multilateral processes. And we've had a very interesting PhD thesis here at the LSE, completed 2013-14 by Kai Monheim, you might have come across him, who's shown that chairs of negotiations, often coming from IOs, can often make that small critical difference in getting to a positive result. So in other words, they provide management, process management capacity. They are able framers of debates and lead states to conclusive outcomes that promote cooperation. So again, they're not necessarily stepping over their mandates, they're just creatively expanding their roles, taking on a much more political role. So again, there's now solid empirical research that shows us what can be done in that area. Let me conclude with perhaps two caveats, and they're not meant to be criticisms, but perhaps areas where we need to, all of us in the discussion, push you a little bit harder. Because of course you've given us cases where mandate expansion has done great things. Well, in two cases it worked more than in the third case, but in terms of thinking through the implications of this work and for the future, I have two caveats. One is, a lot of what you've demonstrated essentially comes down to personalities taking leadership. It may be low-level staffs that do good work around analysis and workshop organizations and discourses that shift the envelope a little bit. Or it may be the leaders that take executive decisions to expand the mandate. But it's difficult to get any sense of how far this can take us if we rely on that sort of immeasurable quality of personality and personal leadership. Who are these people that are expanding the mandate? Where do they come from? What does it take for them to have success? We've almost got a natural experiment coming with Guterres moving now to a much more high-profile role. Of course, as everyone told him as he entered his office, it's the most impossible job you can do in international diplomacy, and he may soon find out that this is just where the limits for personal leadership can be found. But secondly, and more importantly, well, what about states then? I mean, your case study on the UNHCR clearly shows that where mandate expansion goes into the sort of the sensitive areas, you talked about the expansion of legal rights for refugees. This would have made a real inroad into the sovereign rights of states. This is where it hurts. This is where states' interests are affected, and this is where they got pushback. So in a way, I would argue mandate expansion still works where states provide a permissive environment, and where the mandate expansion goes with the grain of global politics in areas where states are quite happy to let this happen. But I'm not yet convinced that mandate expansion is a mechanism where we can see pushback against states that are laggards, that are veto players, that are difficult to convince. I'd love to be convinced otherwise, but I think we have a lot of PhD projects coming our way in that area. So let me just conclude. Terrific book, great research, and it's wonderful to see it out, and I think we need to engage with it very seriously. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Robert. You raised so many issues and made so many interesting observations. Do you want to give some quick comments before we let it open to discussion?
Sure. Yeah. Very happy to do so. Yeah, thank you so much, Robert. It's great to hear your comments on this. We were on a panel a few years ago where I was discussing Robert's work, so it's nice to now reverse it. No, really, really useful comments, so thank you. And to push the argument a little bit, and I think it's really useful to do that, to say, really, how far does this go? Are states really still controlling the purse strings and controlling the mandate? He's right, and in the book I do say there are some limits. States still do have a role. And I think where the interesting debate is over the long period of time. I mean, I only look at 15 years. How can staff chip away at some of the concepts and ideas that states might have about what should and shouldn't be in a mandate? So I think, for me, the jury is still a little bit out on UNHCR and whether they will successfully push. So UNHCR is the one failed case in the sense that they get some mandate expansion, but they can't get it on the really hard area, the hard area being a new convention for people who may be displaced by natural disasters and other things. And what's interesting to look at in that space is that
Guterres missed out in 2011. States blocked him when he tried to advance this. But the agenda is, he's kept pushing it forward. So staff didn't say, okay, we're going to give up now. They worked with a coalition of states, and I mentioned them briefly, some of them including Norway, Switzerland, Geneva, Germany, through the Nansen Initiative, which was a small secretariat in Geneva, and they came up with a protection agenda to try and develop frameworks to protect people across who are displaced across borders. Now, it's still at the very fuzzy stage of global governance where there isn't much you can concretely put your finger at and say, okay, here's the outcome. I'll definitely acknowledge that. But it's set up a space where that negotiation is continuing. We've also, from the UN high-level summit that happened at the opening of the General Assembly, seen similar calls for protection of vulnerable migrants. Again, it's still at the fuzzy space of global governance where it's very unclear how IOM will play into this. And to me, that's the ongoing question, which I guess people who are here in this room and interested in what's going to happen next will be picking up and saying, are we going to see this taken forward? Who are going to be the norm entrepreneurs to try and push protection for people who fall within the gaps of current international law? So I will grant that it is an environment in which states do still wield a lot of control, but I would also push back and say over the long durée, maybe we will see some shifts. I'll open up for Q&A and happy to follow up on anything else. Yeah.
Okay, so now it's time for you to ask questions. So this is being recorded, so please use the microphones and introduce yourselves when you speak. So I have one question up here.
Giacomo Falchetta, environmental economics master student. In your opinion, what are and what will be in the future the incentive for states and governments and nations to invest in climate migrants, in particularly through these organizations, but also directly?
We collect a few and then had one here.
Thank you. I'm a global politics master here, so I just wanted to touch upon the domestic implementation, especially in developing countries. So I was wondering how could the discourse in those countries change to sensibilize the publics in terms of climate change and security, especially given the fact that those countries have their security paradigms much more focused on traditional issues of war. So, yeah.
Can I sort of clarify when you're saying these countries? Do you want to specify?
Developing countries that are affected by natural disaster.
Anyone else?
Yes. Hi, my name is Piero Scalamuaci. I'm with IG actually, but I am most of my career I spent in international organizations, in the IMF and then in EBRD together with Eric. Thank you, Nina and Robert for the excellent presentation and the very thoughtful remarks. So I have many questions, but I limit myself to one. And that is whether the mandate expansion of institutions cannot be linked to externalities. Externalities that originate from country action, i.e. an impact of your own action that impacts not only you, but those around you, positive externalities, you know, I'm growing a flower in my garden and you also enjoy it, or I smoke and the negative externality that you are a second-hand smoker. So this type of things, which is climate change, but also migration, these are type of issues which are difficult for sovereign states to deal with because it's by their nature impacts not only them but also the others and vice versa. So I'm wondering whether a little bit supporting Nina's idea of this positive role of international institutions, whether by the design that they are supranational, they can more internalize this type of externalities and bring it to the agenda to sovereigns by recognizing the limit that you highlight, that if it steps on the toes of sovereigns, maybe it's difficult to handle, but they have a very special mandate in highlighting and suggesting approaches to deal with externalities which are beyond the sovereign's control.
Nina, you want to start with those and then we'll have another round?
That's great. Thank you for all of those questions. So the first question, Yakima, was on investing. Why would states want to invest or assist, I guess you're saying, climate migrants? I mean, first of all, I would be reluctant to endorse the concept of climate migrants. I think there's a lot of confusing terminology out there, but taken for granted that climate change will impact on displacement, so some kind of natural disasters induced migrational displacement. To me, the big question is not just why will states invest in climate migrants or however we want to call them, but actually migrants as a whole. And I think this book is part of a much broader debate that's happening. I also know Eric's doing work in this area about how do we get governments to see the benefits of migration as a whole. And there are some good examples of that. In New Zealand, where I'm from, the government has for about 10 years now had a labour migration scheme with a number of the Pacific Islands. So a number of Pacific Islands were former colonies or have very close relationships with the New Zealand government. And migrants will come both because they have family, personal connections in New Zealand, as well as coming for working in the agricultural sector where we have a lack of migrants. And this is actually often highlighted as a scheme, the regional, the regional agricultural scheme, which is something that we should be thinking about more broadly. Rather than in my talk, I focus mostly on sort of humanitarian mechanisms to offer people ways to move. We can actually try and assist migration through giving people legal channels before they are forced to make decisions. And you offer legal channels like this one by thinking about where you need work, labour, and that can be beneficial to society. So it doesn't have to be purely conceived in a humanitarian sense. Obviously, there are some situations which it's only, you know, humanitarian if Haiti gets hit by, you know, an earthquake or a storm like we've seen recently. So my broader answer would be we need to think about how society values migrants more generally. So on the domestic question about developing countries and the security implications was the question as I understood it. How do they deal with the security implications of some of this? Is that right? Yeah. So I haven't monitored or I'm not aware of how different developing countries, whether it be India or Kenya, think about climate change or climate migrants in a security context. Obviously, every country is very specific. So the research I did in Kenya, there is very heightened concern about Somalia and Al-Shabaab using refugee camps in Kenya as a recruiting spot. And in fact, that's one of the reasons the Kenyan government has given for closing down Dadaab, the refugee camp. I think that's, again, it's fitting into a broader notion of how do we see refugees and migrants that's not necessarily related to their link to climate change per se. And I think, again, it comes back to this underlying, how do we rethink our ideas about refugees and migrants. So I don't have one easy answer for that because I think it's very context dependent, whether you're talking about Kenya or in Bangladesh and other places. And then the last question, thanks, Peroska, on externalities. I think you're right to point out that, yes, international institutions and the people working for them aren't thinking or trapped in the same way that governments are in thinking about sovereignty, and they are thinking at a more global level about global challenges. And what I really saw in the work I was doing is that they think about what are the root causes, what is driving some of the problems that we're seeing, that we're coming across in our work. And as you go back and back, climate change obviously comes up as one of several root causes that are leading to many of the problems, whether it be displacement or we didn't talk as much here about problems around development. So I do think that if we can talk about, if we want to talk about it as externalities or collective action problems, is a big part of how these issues are being framed and then who is picking up on them.
Okay. One here. And one here.
Thanks for an interesting talk. I'm Kathy Hosteller, professor in international development. One set of actors that didn't come up in your discussion were NGOs, and that seems like kind of a big gap because there are humanitarian, development, climate NGOs, many of whom are making exactly these same kinds of connections between climate and refugees. Mm-hmm. Do you find them not at all influential in your cases? Do you see the line of causation going the other way? Are they following your international organizations, or where do they fit into this story?
Thanks.
Do that first, and then we come to you.
Hi, my name is Olivia from LSE Ideas and the Dahrendorf Forum. My question was about leaders and bureaucracy, so maybe picking up on what Robert said on what does that mean, or how can we kind of use the knowledge that leaders are powerful, what type of leaders have to be in the institution then, but also what motivates bureaucracies to expand? Is it budget? Is it projects? Is it control, influence? What did you find in your cases? Thank you.
And maybe to follow that up, you know, you have a good test now because you have someone who has a political background, like Gutierrez, and you had someone who was a hyper-bureaucrat as his predecessor, so you can at least speculate on the background of Gutierrez, how it played it in UNHCR. Please.
Thank you. My name is Basanti. I'm from the University of California in Davis. So my question is, in your opinion, are mandate expansions, for example, in this case, within the case studies that you've done of migration, strong enough to spill over to other subsections of the concept of climate justice and the safeguard of those that are affected the most, especially when it comes to human rights and things like that? So do you think it's strong enough to spill over into other areas that need expanding as well? And can it make a difference?
Okay, you want to start with this?
Yeah, that's great. On the NGO question, thanks very much for that, because I didn't have a chance to expand in the presentation. So the chapter that I highlighted on issue linkages, I mentioned briefly a couple of NGOs, Greenpeace, Oxfam, in the presentation, but there were actually a number of others who were involved in forging and framing the connections between climate change and displacement. So that was one of the issue linkages, and the other was climate change and development. So as we heard also from Robert, there was a big shift in the way we thought about climate change. And the key actors who were part of the key stakeholders who were pushing this were also NGOs. And they had many reasons for doing so. One, as we've already heard, was to make states take action on climate change. So there were actually a number of environmental NGOs, Friends for the Earth, Climate Change, Greenpeace, who were saying that climate change was going to lead to millions of people moving, and they were doing so with the intention of trying to get governments to reach an agreement. They were saying migration is, you know, we understand states think migration is a threat, so you better hurry up and do something about climate change, because otherwise you're going to get migrants on your shores. And there was, you know, a movie that I saw at Copenhagen by an American, which was called Climate Refugees, and had exactly this kind of pitch, and he was talking to all sorts of politicians and NGOs. So actually the environmental NGO movement particularly had a strong role to play in forging that connection. And there are some interesting groups that are now trying to work between the environmental NGO movement and the migration refugee to try and nuance some of the ways that environmental groups who didn't really understand the way refugee and migration groups are trying to have a much different, more positive view of migrants that the environmental groups weren't necessarily supporting. So I completely agree. NGOs did have a role to play, and of course they've also had a role to play on the ground. So then, yeah, Olivia, thanks for the question to follow up on leadership. It's a really good, hard question, and international relations scholarship, as a lot of social science, really struggles to model and theoretically explain the influence of individual leaders. I've been working on an article on this, and it's hard. And that's partly because of the idiosyncrasies that we've already heard of individuals. When, how do we model charisma? You know, how do we understand who's going to take up? Sometimes, you know, secretary generals seem to be very weak leaders, and then they get into the role, and like people like Kofi Annan or Hammarskjöld are much more impactful than we would expect them to be. I think there are a couple of things that we can ask, though, about leaders, about, first of all, their formal abilities. So to what extent are they chairing negotiations of the board? Can they set agendas? Or do they have a much more backroom role? To what extent do they have control over their financing? Increasingly in international organizations, we see states earmarking all of their funds. And what that means is that you have very little control as a leader, because states have already set out what they want the organization to do, and you have no discretionary budget. So there are some ways that we can look at the structures which leaders are operating in without having to get into the tricky area of, you know, modeling their charisma or doing personality types. And I think it would be really good for the leadership literature to move in that way, to try and understand the structures that they're operating in. And one thing I think also that I didn't hint on here is, and you asked me, Olivia, about what motivates these organizations to expand. I argue here and in the book very strongly on this issue linkage, that staff are motivated because they're seeing how a new issue impacts on their work and they're concerned by it because they have a strong loyalty to their mandate. I would also add to that, and I've done other work that showed how funding opportunities will also structure and influence, and that's something that hasn't come up in the conversation so far, but that of course alongside these trends we saw an increase in climate financing. And for some organizations, particularly the UNDP case, they had a lot of access to the Global Environment Facility and other adaptation funds, which meant they could expand into new areas because they had financing to do so. So that's something else that I think is very important to be aware of. And the last question on spillover mandate expansion. It's hard for me to answer this simply because I think climate justice is a sort of different lens that many NGOs have advocated for, but these organizations wouldn't necessarily put themselves or talk about that lens about spillover. Were there other cases that you were thinking of specifically in terms of spillover or... I mean, I would say that most of these organizations, so the UNHCR, IOM, UNDP, they're all present in the negotiations and they're all, to some extent, pushing for solutions that are going to assist developing countries because they're the people that, by and large, they're seeing themselves as representing, in addition, of course, to their member states. So to that extent, yes, that spillover is occurring, but I'm not sure that they would frame it themselves as strongly as saying we're advocating for climate justice. I think that voice would come from somewhere else.
Okay, do we have another round? There's one over there, one here, and one there.
Hello. My name is Fabian. I'm in the MSc Environmental Economics here at LSE. And I wanted to ask you, like, given the arising problems in terms of democracy with going beyond their mandates, do you have any suggestions how to prevent IOs from going beyond their mandates and maybe establishing some kind of early warning system for states that they start thinking about these problems by themselves without push by IOs?
Good evening. My name is Kazadira. Following up on the talk about NGOs and about developing countries, I'm interested to see whether or not this global governance, these international institutions, actually exclude the voices coming in from developing countries and from NGOs from developing countries. Are there any kind of different treatments given to them, or is it equal? Because if we see environmental refugees, developing countries are the most affected, but we don't really see them kind of steering the debate and discussion. I'm just really curious as to why that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hi. My name is Carlos León, former student of politics at the University of Sheffield. I think something has been mentioned about the role of states in argument, and I wonder if you could see any relationship between the reconfiguration of the global economy with your argument about this new adaptation of international institutions and the discussion about and the link with climate change. Because I wonder whether this configuration, let's say, the increase of power in China in terms of economic power might have some effect into as to whether these institutions are able to actually discuss more freely the issue of climate change, you know what I mean?
So the question is about economic power shifts within the global economy, sorry?
Yeah, pretty much is whether you see in your work any relationship between the reconfiguration of power in the global economy in this issue that you see as part of your argument.
Great, thanks for another good set of questions. So on the first question, the challenge was, are international organizations the right place, really, to be looking out for global challenges? Should states have an early warning system and be looking first off before international organizations to figure out new trends and issues? I think that's an interesting question. There is it comes back, I guess, to Podolska's question earlier about who's doing the thinking at the global level for us to notice new trends and new intersecting issues that are affecting the international community. I don't see it as problematic that international organizations are doing this thinking for us. In many ways, that's what member states delegate to international organizations to do. They delegate to them for expertise as neutral actors to think through how intersecting issues, whether it be climate change and displacement or development, are affecting the world. And I think that, in addition, states then have an ability to work with those organizations to pursue it. So I don't think they need I wouldn't think there is a need for an early warning system for states. Obviously, some have their own strategic capacities within foreign ministries to think about these sorts of issues, but I guess I don't see a need for it. On the second question, are we excluding developing countries from the conversations? This is a tricky question because obviously there are many different negotiations that are happening within the international organizations that I study, UNHCR, IOM, UNDP. They all have governing boards. And on those governing boards, it's a bit different from, say, the IMF and the World Bank, where you have weighted voting. And these boards, most of them are working on a majority, so one country, one vote, and they include donors as well as developing countries. So developing countries can have an influence. And I guess this also relates to the third question about do global power shifts, like the rise, if you want to say, of China, of India, of the BRICS, have an impact on how decisions are being made? It wasn't something that came up distinctly in this particular area. I think you could look in other global governance areas of these institutions or others where it clearly is, but it wasn't something that I saw happening to any strong extent.
More questions? Can I ask you a thing which is kind of an obvious question? So, you know, you observe a global challenge, and then you ask yourself, are you going to ask existing institutions to change their mandate, or are you going to create new institutions? So, you know, since I'm involved in an Institute of Global Affairs and you know, getting involved in many different discussions about global challenges, and the answer is almost always to create another international institution. So how do you see this trade-off?
It's a very good question. Actually, Duncan Snidell's written a book on exactly this question. Should we use existing institutions? Should we select new ones? Or should we establish and create a completely new institution? And the way they come at this question is from a sort of historical institutionalist approach combined with a rational choice approach, and saying states will generally opt for the least risky option. So they'll use an existing institution if they think they can, but if for whatever reason that institution doesn't fit or it's not competent, they may go away and create another one. I think what's interesting normatively is that we have an increasing tendency, I would argue, in global governance to mainstream. So when we see new issues coming up, there's also a tendency to say we need to address gender and gender inequalities, so we need to mainstream gender. And you've seen that with the environment. A lot of institutions, it's not just create a new environment institution. We need to mainstream environment. We need environmental safeguards. And I think that's a really interesting question. I've actually once thought it'd be great to do some analysis around the difference between gender mainstreaming and environmental mainstreaming and how that's taken off. We're also seeing that with HIV/AIDS being mainstream. So, it's a very good question. And I think at the moment it looks like there won't be any specific new institution created for adaptation. And the UN the past UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon specifically said that. He said he wanted all the UN system to be working on it.
The institution work, but Prosko and I worked on, actually, so this was the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and it had in its charter a specific clause that asked it to sunset, you know, once its mission had been achieved. Of course, in this case, when you look to climate change, of course, that mission seems so large and so extended over time that it's maybe not a meaningful question, but it's an interesting question. You know, these institutions, they are created to address certain purposes, and you, as you show, these institutions evolve over time and they grow beyond the purpose, and sometimes they may just create new missions to justify their existence, even though the kind of original reasons. Actually, you can argue that some of those institutions, the original reasons kind of went away. You know, you can take the World Bank is a good example. The World Bank was created actually to deal with Europe's development challenge. And then, you know, you found you had this institution that had all this knowledge and all this experience and all these people. And then you try to look for where can we apply it instead. You know, how do you see that? You show that, you know, whether it's about leaders or what staff, you know, there are very strong forces within these institutions that kind of make them get a life on their own. You know, it's incredibly hard to make these institutions decrease. I remember in the beginning at the BRD, as I was there from 2006 onwards, in the first few years it was really about, particularly from the United States, which is the largest shareholder in the institution, they were trying to bring this sort of sunset, not immediately, but gradually, by making the EBRD leave Eastern Europe, or the part of Eastern Europe that was part of the European Union, so Central and Eastern Europe. As soon as we started to think about that question, you know, people got really scared. So people who were working in Warsaw, working in Prague, or working in another of these countries that were already EU members, they started wanting to move away. So once you tell an organization that, you know, these areas are not going to be priority areas, people will move away, and they will anticipate, even if it's happening 10 years from now. So how do we think of these institutions and how we, you kind of looked at this from a more descriptive perspective, but, you know, when you think about designing these institutions, how should we go about doing it? Is it realistic to put in sunset clauses? Is it, you know, how do we deal with, you know, transferring resources in institutions to maybe or bringing people into institutions? The new Asian institutions are being created now. China is creating its own international institutions, and they're taking people from existing institutions. How should we think of these issues of institutions evolving over time and addressing new challenges?
I think it's a good question that takes us back also to the origins of these organizations. And as I was pointing out in the talk, that in a way, IOM, UNHCR, less so UNDP, had sunset clauses. UNHCR, interestingly, until about 15, 20 years ago, had to go back to the UN General Assembly to renew its mandate, because it only had a mandate for a several year period, and they had to go back and get it renewed, even though it's been a key actor in humanitarian affairs. And what's interesting here is that they were conceived to set up to deal with discrete problems. So like you said, in the World Bank was reconstructed in Europe, where UNHCR was only, and I didn't go into this in the presentation, only for European refugees. It wasn't until 1967 that you could be a refugee and come from outside Europe and fall within the UNHCR, which is incredible thinking about this in today's context. So the problem was very discrete. Same for IOM, it was only labour migrants in Europe. Now, I guess the interesting question is, at a high level, how do we want to think about our global governance? Do we want to set up institutions just for very discrete problems? So when we have Palestinian refugees, we set up an organization. When we have European refugees, we set up an organization, which is what happened. We still have a Palestinian refugee organization that's separate from UNHCR. Or do we want organizations that deal with underlying problems and themes that, as much as we want, probably aren't ever going to disappear, in which case, you know, maybe we need not necessarily a sunset clause, but we need some kind of performance review to see how you're going towards achieving it. But we need these organizations to be set up in such ways that they can see, actually, now the big problem is, you know, displacement in a different part of the globe. It's no longer Europe, it's somewhere else, or it's into Europe. And it's that flexibility of organizations to be able to adapt and use their expertise and deploy it in the right ways. And I would think that is the crucial question that we have to be thinking about.
Robert. Just quickly on your interesting question. We could involve the audience here. Can we see, show of hands, can you think of any international organization that ever closed down? Yeah. Got a lot of intelligence in this room. Come on. Anyone? No? Think again. No? Interesting answer. In 1946, the League of Nations was closed down. What happened to the buildings in Geneva? Taken over by the United Nations. So this was more a kind of a closure and takeover. So the work carried on. But I ask this question every year in my teaching, and we've never got beyond the League of Nations. It's interesting, not a single institution, whether they have a sunset clause or not, has ever been closed down. Now, logically, there are probably two explanations that should explain this. One, bureaucratic politics. Once you've got an infrastructure with jobs and pensions and roles, people will find new ways of keeping themselves alive. So that's mission creep and that sort of missions taken away from states. But the other reason, perhaps the more serious one, is that most of them deal with global governance challenges that just aren't easily solvable. That you know, climate change, migration, poverty alleviation, development, these are not tasks where you can come in like, you know, from a business perspective, you know, you've got a task, you meet it, close down the business and move on and create something new. I think that speaks to the complexity of global governance challenges, and I suspect, therefore, that we've got an inbuilt logic of ever greater demand for global governance, but also ever greater supply of global governance as well.
Yes, for you, Dr. You worry about whether the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development was eventually closed down. On the contrary, because the financial crisis created a new demand for both for in the financial institutions area dealing with the banking system, but also, you know, a lot of countries were hit. Well, actually, Eastern Europe was the region most hit by the global crisis. So again, your argument for it was asked to go into North Africa, whole new mandate had never contemplated at the beginning when it was created. And it's also now very active in climate change. So it's actually something like one third of its projects are climate change, specifically climate change related. So it's a good example of an institution that was set up to close down after it has addressed its original mandate of helping transition in Eastern Europe, but has taken on a life of its own. I think we've had a fantastically interesting discussion. Thanks very much to Nina and to Robert and to, most of all, to your excellent questions. And I'm very encouraged that we can fill a room like this on issues of global governance, because these are extremely important issues. And so thank you very much, all of you, and thank you, Nina.
Thank you.